Hi, I'm Neil Stavem. I want to thank you for listening to this podcast from Connecting Faith. There are many more podcasts available at our website, myfaithradio.com. And your support makes this possible.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Welcome to Connecting Faith. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Joe Bender in for Neil Stavem. Happy New Year. If this is the first time you are listening to Connecting Faith in the new year, it's the first time I'm on Connecting Faith for the new year. So that's why I feel like Happy New Year is in order. Happy New Year, Ted.
Yeah, to you too. Thank you, Joe. It's good to be back in the full swing here. Some people have already been at it for more than a day.
Yes.
And they didn't get a break, perhaps, right?
Right. That is absolutely true. And hopefully people are staying warm today. We have a bitter cold snap here in the Midwest. And if you're listening to us from afar, then you can just have some sympathy, I guess. But it's been a beautiful winter so far, and so now we just have a couple of days of cold. Well, maybe you are a person who sets some New Year's resolutions. I've been reading a couple of studies that say people don't really do it very much anymore. Instead, they find that things are unattainable, and so they just don't make an effort at all.
Just don't even try, huh? You know, David Wheaton talked about this morning on Dr. Bill Meyer Live, and you can access that interview, of course, myfaithradio.com if you want to hear that, too. He talks about going to Scripture first before you make a resolution. Really good.
Ooh, that's good. Well, I have a list of the top 10 New Year's resolutions for most Americans, and they are very typical. Now, maybe these people didn't go to Scripture first. I don't know. But diet, eating healthy, exercising more, losing weight, maybe something like quitting smoking. Those are really the top. Those are the top five New Year's resolutions that are made.
So self-help, kind of improving your health overall.
Trying to improve yourself and improve your health. I was surprised to see that 16% of respondents said they're going to be trying to find a new job.
Wow. Yeah, there's a lot of people that go to work every day that are miserable, unfortunately.
Right. And maybe it's a little reset. Now, I find that September seems to be more of a reset for me. The kids are off to school.
Yeah.
The semester begins again here at Northwestern, and that seems to be my reset time. So New Year's, I don't know, but I did make a commitment that I'm going to make sure I get to the fitness club at least three times a week.
You're going to do it.
And I made it measurable because I also read that you're supposed to set SMART goals: specific, measurable, attainable, realistic, and time bound.
All right.
Mm-hmm.
Good for you. I'm also in the thought that I will be going to the gym more regularly. I should probably consider and pray about how many times a week I'm going to do that. So I will do that.
All right. I'll ask you for a number next week.
All right.
All right. Well, one of the other things that, of course, took place over the last couple of weeks is seeing a lot of family members. Maybe you also were blessed with being able to spend some time with family. And so it did get me thinking about this subject, knowing that this was coming up, because today we're going to talk about Alzheimer's and caring for elderly parents. It can be something that's very stressful. And of course, it can be something that a lot of us don't have a lot of experience in or a lot of knowledge with. So we're very blessed today to have with us author and educator Deborah Barr. She's going to talk about caring for someone with Alzheimer's disease and also how to show love to caregivers who may be struggling to connect with their loved ones. Something we don't always think about is how stressful it might be for the person who's caring for the person who is either aging or affected with Alzheimer's disease. A couple of statistics. As of 2016, 5.4 million Americans had Alzheimer's disease, and nearly two-thirds of them are women. And one in nine Americans aged 65 or older has Alzheimer's disease. And so that means that if you don't already have someone you care about who's affected, you probably will in the future. At present, there's no way, of course, to prevent or cure or even slow the progression of Alzheimer's disease. So it's a great subject that's going to probably affect many people. Let me tell you a little bit about my guest so we can get started with the show. Deborah Barr is an experienced wellness writer, speaker, and health educator. She holds a master's degree in health education and also volunteers as a community educator for the Western Carolina chapter of the Alzheimer's Association. She lives in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, and her book is called Keeping Love Alive as Memories Fade. And this is also co-authored with two other individuals, and I'll let Deborah tell us about that. Welcome, Deborah.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
It's such a great...
So my co-authors, you were asking about my co-authors,
yes, it's such
Dr.
A great...
Gary Chapman.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Dr. Gary Chapman and Dr. Ed Shaw.
And so Gary Chapman had an interesting, I guess, contribution because Dr. Shaw, tell us a little bit about that background. Dr. Shaw actually has a wife who was affected with early onset Alzheimer's.
That's right. His wife, Rebecca, was diagnosed with early onset Alzheimer's at age 53, and she just passed away recently, right before our book was published, but she struggled with that for 9 years. And Dr. Shaw actually did a complete reroute of his career in order to become more or less her primary caregiver. He was a radiation oncologist for many years here at Wake Forest Baptist Medical Center in Winston-Salem. And when he realized what her next 9 years and the rest of their family life would be characterized by, he actually went back to school, got a master's degree in mental health counseling, and founded a memory counseling program at the hospital. And that is where I met him as his clinic coordinator.
Hmm. Well, it just, and he had written quite a bit about how the words of Gary Chapman really came in handy as he learned how to love his wife and how to express love, even though she was losing her memory. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, the most amazing thing about this book is how it happened. I suppose there's a story behind every book that's ever been written, but the way this one happened was just a God thing, it really was, because about 30 years prior, I had worked for Dr. Gary Chapman and had a little bit of an opportunity to give him some administrative support when he wrote the original Five Love Languages book. So that was in the back of my mind all these years. You know, fast forward to 2014, I'm working in the memory counseling clinic, and you meet so many couples and families and individuals who are dealing with that diagnosis of dementia, Alzheimer's or another dementia. And I became aware that Dr. Shaw was using the five love languages in his counseling with people struggling with dementia and dementia kind of interrupting the flow of relationships in the family. And I knew because of my prior connection with the love languages that this was very novel. I knew no one else was doing this. So I thought, well, you know, I'll bet Dr. Chapman would at least like to know this. And so I just called him up and we talked about what I had discovered. And by the end of the phone call, we were talking about a book because we knew this was an entirely different way to use the five love languages.
So the book is called Keeping Love Alive as Memories Fade, The Five Love Languages and the Alzheimer's Journey. So one of the things that you start out with in the book is just how Alzheimer's disease takes a huge toll, not only on the person affected with the disease, but the person who loves the person affected with the disease. Can you expand on that?
Absolutely. In our book, we talk about the effect that Alzheimer's or another dementia has on relationships as kind of an unraveling tapestry. And it unravels, interestingly, from both sides of the relationship. On the side of the person with the disease, it unravels because of the disease. They lose their ability to take the initiative. They are not able to connect with you as well. And as the disease progresses, you know, they lose their verbal skills and they lose the things that bring connection to another person. But on the side of the healthy person, the person who doesn't have a diagnosis of dementia, there is some unraveling as well due to fear of what is this disease that's taking over our family? What does the future hold? There is some grief because nobody plans to spend their retirement years taking care of a spouse with dementia. And so there's kind of a backing up from both sides, and that's really the need, I think, that my co-author, Dr. Shaw, saw, because he would say that 100% of all the people he's ever counseled who are dealing with dementia are emotionally disconnected in some way, whether it's a parent and a child or two spouses or even, you know, a friend, two friends. there's a disconnect that occurs there. And so there's an awful lot of stress, there's guilt, there's all kind of things going on that may not be readily apparent.
How does dementia threaten that emotional glue that a relationship is supposed to have?
Oh, that's such an interesting question. There are so many ways. We mention a whole list of those in the book, but it's not by any means, exhaustive. Some of the things that happen have to do with just the fact that the behaviors of the person with the disease become really odd and really stressful. And just for some examples, they tend to, at a certain point in the disease, where they literally can't remember from one minute to the next, they tend to ask the same question over and over and over. For example, if you said, the kids are kind of home for Thanksgiving this year, but you tell the person in October, you may answer the question, when are they going to get here, maybe 100 times. And that can be extremely stressful on the part of the caregiver. And it tends to create a little bit of static between the relationship. Excuse me. Then there are things like mistaken identity. At a certain point in the disease, the person who is struggling with dementia may mistake their spouse for their child or their sister or brother, depending on the gender. And that throws a really strange dynamic into a marriage. Then there are things like delusions. About 70% of people with Alzheimer's at some point in their disease will begin to have delusional thinking. And a delusion is just the belief that something's true when it's not, and there's really no evidence to say that it is. But it can be due to things like sensory overload, bright lights, too much noise, or maybe shadows as the day wears on that distort the appearance of common objects. And so a person with dementia might believe, for example, that the people on TV are actually in the room, or they might believe that dolls or figurines are real. And then they might have paranoid delusions, which are, false beliefs that make the person suspicious or distrustful. They may think somebody is spying on them or somebody's stealing their money or their clothes. And probably the worst one, as far as a marriage is concerned, is they may become convinced that their spouse is having an affair despite, any evidence to support that. And so there's just a lot of stuff that happens with the relationship. And I would have to say that what makes our book unique among all the wonderful books that are out there on Alzheimer's disease, ours doesn't focus so much on the disease itself as on what the disease does to relationships. And that's our distinguishing factor, I guess you'd say.
Well, we're going to talk to Deborah Barb a bit more when we come back on Connecting Faith and her book, Keeping Love Alive as Memories Fade, The Five Love Languages and the Alzheimer's Journey. We'll hear more from Deborah coming up on Connecting Faith.
Love is not proud. Love does not boast. Love, after all, matters the most.
Welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm Joe Bender, and today I'm blessed to be talking with Deborah Barr, who is the author of Keeping Love Alive as Memories Fade, The Five Love Languages and the Alzheimer's Journey. Deborah, how can people may not be familiar with the five love languages. Can you give kind of an overview and then tell us how we can identify which of those love languages might be most important to the person who we're caring for?
Sure, absolutely. Just real briefly, the five love languages. Well, first to just explain that every one of us has at least one channel or one way that love speaks to us most loudly. I guess you could call it a language or you could call it a channel, but Gary Chapman, in his original Five Love Languages book, named five, and they are words of affirmation, meaning unsolicited compliments, words of appreciation like, hey, you did a great job, or you look great in that dress. Quality time, which is giving somebody your undivided attention. And it could be also quality experiences, like a, you know, a day trip or something special that you do as a family. Some people feel most loved by a gift, you know, a tangible expression of love. For other people, it's acts of service. Somebody who rolls up their sleeve and says, hey, what can I do to help? Give me that vacuum cleaner. I'll walk the dog, whatever they need. And then physical touch, that's non-sexual touch. That would be, you know, a hug, a high five, a back rub, those kinds of things. And those five are easily discovered, which one is your main one, through a quiz. There's just a simple quiz that's in our book, and it's also at 5lovelanguages.com. You just take the quiz, total your scores, and then make sure that what you come out with really resonates with you. In other words, that does seem to be the way it really is for you. And that way you can identify your love language. And if you're taking care of a person who has dementia, there's a way to discover their love language as well. And the way that you discover that really depends on the stage of their disease. Early on, it can be the same quiz. In the middle stages, it can be administering that quiz like an interview. And then at the more severe stages, it's a combination of taking the quiz on their behalf, answering as you knew they would pre-dementia, and then answering a couple of questions. So it's a discoverable thing up until a point where you have to kind of do a little bit of guesswork based on your knowledge of the person. And in the book, we talk about the fact that for a cognitively healthy person, your love language is pretty much hardwired into your personality, meaning, you know, if words of affirmation make you feel loved when you're 18, words of affirmation will probably still make you feel loved when you're 98. But Alzheimer's disease is the exception to that, because as the brain changes, the love language may change too. And so it's kind of a thing that you have to keep up with, stay a little bit vigilant, see what seems to be resonating with the person as time goes on. And very, very late in the disease, we recommend that you speak all five love languages.
And why is that?
Well, the reason for that, we took our cue from a book called The Five Love Languages of Children. And the reason we did that is as Alzheimer's progresses, people become increasingly childlike. We give a little story in the book where Dr. Shaw's daughter, Carrie, had come home from college, I guess it was college, for the weekend and to spend time with her mom. And at the end of the day, she tucked Rebecca into bed. And Rebecca looked up and said, wow, it was so much fun playing with the big kids today. Mm. And we knew from that she was perceiving life as a child at that point in her disease, which was pretty far along. So by the end of the disease, we take the cue from that book about the love languages in children and just, you speak their primary one as you know it, but you also speak the other four. And because the love languages can change as the disease progresses, we sort of feel like that's just insurance that you're gonna hit the right one if you speak all five.
And then is there the benefit of knowing these love languages is also to help the person with dementia to express love, correct?
Right. We have a chapter in our book devoted to facilitating that person with the disease, facilitating their speaking love to other people. Because one of the things that happens is that the person with the disease loses the ability to plan because their executive function is affected, and they lose the ability to take the initiative. So even if they can think of something wonderful to do, they can't take the initiative. They can't drive, they can't shop, they can't create something without a facilitator. But we've discovered that with a facilitator, they can have plenty of enjoyment and satisfaction in reaching out in love, just as we all do. You know, it's kind of rewarding. If you give someone a gift and their face lights up, that's your reward. And a person with dementia can experience the reward. They just can't make the gift happen without some help.
Hmm. And so it's important to understand what that person who has Alzheimer's or has dementia, it's important to understand their love languages as well, because you might be helping them to express that love language in the future.
Exactly. Exactly.
What about some other mental abilities that are associated with Alzheimer's disease? I know just from reading an experience that sometimes we may not see the things they're mentally capable of, and yet Alzheimer's patients are actually capable of a lot of mental capacities even well into their journey, correct?
That is correct. And the reason people make the assumption that those mental abilities aren't there is because of what the person's lost in the way of giving you feedback or, you know, having verbal skills. But very often, you know, if you facilitate and work with a person, you will see that they do, in fact, surprise you with what they're still capable of. And, of course, you know, we have to constantly remind people this is a incurable neurodegenerative disease. In other words, it kills brain cells and function declines as that happens. But until the person is far along in their disease, they're probably capable of more than we might guess just based on their responsiveness to us.
Well, and it does seem like it's a very difficult journey to have to endure when we don't necessarily know all the ins and outs of that of Alzheimer's disease. And it seems like doctors and specialists are still figuring that out. It seems like we don't have all the answers on that yet, do we?
No, absolutely not. It's a little bit is known, but there's a lot of mystery to it as well. You're right.
And you write that music is effective at improving dementia patients' mood and maybe their behavior. How was this discovered?
I don't know how it was discovered, but it is pretty widely known now that music can have a profound effect on a person with dementia. It taps into another part of the brain that isn't so much affected by the disease. And it's just amazing. A person who can barely speak can sometimes sing very accurately the lyrics to a song. And so one of the very, very best gifts you could ever give to a person with dementia is an iPod loaded with music from their teenage or their early adult years. They call it reminiscence music, because that will stimulate them emotionally. It may, you know, stimulate their memory, and it has a profound effect on their countenance and their behavior and all kinds of really good things.
I'm talking to Deborah Barr today, author of Keeping Love Alive as Memories Fade, The Five Love Languages, and The Alzheimer's Journey. We'll talk more with Deborah when we return from our break. Maybe you have a question that you'd like to ask her. You can give us a call at 877-93-FAITH, 877-933-2484. We also have a couple of Deborah's books to give away. We'd love to get that in your hands. Or if you know someone who's involved in the Alzheimer's journey.
I will cast my cares on you. You're the anchor of my hope, the only one who's in control. I will cast my cares.
Welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm Joe Bender in for Neil Stavem today. Today, very blessed to be talking to author Deborah Barr about her book, Keeping Love Alive as Memories Fade. We're talking about the Alzheimer's journey, how difficult it can be for those who are caring for a person with dementia or Alzheimer's. Deborah is a specialist in this area. She's an experienced wellness writer, a speaker, and health educator. She has a master's degree in health education and promotion, and she also volunteers as a community educator for the Western Carolina chapter of the Alzheimer's Association. She She lives in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. And Keeping Love Alive as Memories Fade is her fourth book. Deborah, we were talking a bit about what it meant to have Alzheimer's, but we haven't talked much about what it means for that partner, the person who is kind of in charge of caring for a person with Alzheimer's. Talk a bit about that stress, that toll of stress on a care partner.
Wonderful, wonderful refocus on that. I am so in awe of the care partners that I know, and we interviewed so many for this book. Just incredible commitment, you know, incredible carrying out of those marriage vows. It's a tough job. It is such a tough job because it becomes a one-way street at a certain point when the person with the disease can no longer respond, can no longer be physically intimate, can no longer, you know, share those conversations and activities. So it really is a labor of love, absolutely. We even have a word that we pulled from Hebrew to describe that kind of love because it's such a selfless love that goes beyond what we're really capable of ourselves. The word is hesed, and I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right or not, but it's a word from the Hebrew that's a combination of love and loyalty, and that's what it takes to love somebody who can't love you back in the way that a person with dementia, you know, that increasingly becomes the case. But it's tough to be a caregiver. About 40% are clinically depressed. Many don't get the sleep they need because the person with dementia may be up and down all night or they may wander. They carry a lot of stress. They tend to neglect their own health. And I'm kind of on a little crusade to encourage those people to really prioritize their own health. And that's not selfish. That's really smart because if something happens to you, you have to think about what would happen to the person, you know, for whom you provide care. So we like to say caregiving is a team sport. And you really cannot play all the positions on the team. And if you try to, you may burn out or you may bail out. Some people do bail out because this is not for the faint of heart. And it's a long journey. You know, the typical person after diagnosis is going to live 8 to 10 years. And so it's 8 to 10 years of caregiving for a declining situation. It's not going to get better. It's going to get tougher, and you really have to have support. You have to have help. And that's where we see the five love languages coming in to support the caregiver. You know, once the caregiver discovers their own love language and they share that with their friends and their family and their care team, hopefully those folks will use the love language to reach out to the caregiver. And you know, everything you do for the caregiver ultimately benefits the person in their care as well because they need support, they need good rest, they need fun and recreation, all kinds of things that we all need. And nobody can be in that long situation without, you know, some respite. And that's what we urge people to do for caregivers.
I have a caregiver on the phone right now who would really like to ask a question for you, Deborah. Sherry, are you there?
Yes, I appreciate you talking about the subject today. My husband and I have both been Christian all these years, and he's developed this dementia about a year ago. And it's very, very stressful, very, very heartbreaking. And I was just wondering...
Oh, bless you, Sherry. I have your question up here. I'm going to ask it for you, okay?
Yeah.
All right. Sherry just had a question on how to deal with the diagnosis. It's very tough on the entire family. And how can she, what's her best avenue to reach out for help?
Oh, Sherry, my heart goes out to you. I can understand the emotion in your voice, and it tells me how tough this is, and you know, God bless you. I would probably suggest a couple of things. Number one, I would suggest to really educate yourself about the disease, about what is going to happen. And you can, if you don't know a place in your community where you can get that in person, the Alzheimer's Association website is probably the best resource I know. They absolutely go into every detail. There's lots of good stuff there. But the other thing I would suggest for your consideration is to try to find a support group for caregivers, because nobody but another caregiver really understands, you know, what this is like and how emotionally difficult it can be and how physically difficult it can be. But as we were writing the book, we met with some caregiver support groups. We even did a focus group with some of those people. And the support and the affirmation and the understanding that goes back and forth between fellow caregivers is just priceless. You really can't get that anywhere else. Those would be my top two ideas for you.
Sherry, are you still there?
I am.
Do you have another question?
Did she have any special Bible verses that would be very helpful for me right now?
Oh, bless your heart. The thing I would love to recommend to you is Johnny Erickson and her ministry has just come out with a Bible specifically for people who are suffering in some way. And I purchased this Bible. I'm just starting to look at it. It looks wonderful. And there are many little articles and devotionals and side things in there that I think would be tremendously helpful to you right now. I wish I could remember the exact title of it, but if you could get online and just Google, you know, Johnny Erickson Bible, perhaps you could find it that way. But there's innumerable verses that will carry you, and my compassion is so great for caregivers. I'm actually working on a devotional book for caregivers right now, and that should be out next January. But the need to immerse yourself in the Word and pray about everything, remember that you're not alone. Remember that Jesus' name is Emmanuel, which translated means God with us. God is with you every step of the way. There's not a moment of your day when he's not present with you, and you can call on him at any moment. That would be the biggest hug I could give you, is the presence of Jesus.
Deborah, thanks so much just for sharing that with Sherry. And Sherry, that Bible is called the Beyond Suffering Bible by Johnny Erickson Tada. And we will also make sure you get a copy of Deborah's book as well. It has a lot of great advice there for caregivers. And we're just barely scratching the surface in this interview. So I hope that those will both bless you in your journey. Deborah, maybe you can talk a little bit about how to be a friend to a caregiver. You write so just extensively about that in the book and how essential it is. If you know someone who is caring for a person with Alzheimer's or dementia, or even an elderly parent, what should a friend's response be to that person?
Well, you know, I would almost tie that again back to the five love languages, because once you know what means the very most to a particular caregiver, you can emphasize that in the way that you reach out. For example, if the person's love language is quality time, you can arrange, you know, you can take the initiative to call and say, hey, can I come over for a cup of tea? Or, hey, can I just sit with you and hear what's going on? Or you can arrange for someone to come in and sit with the person with dementia and take that person out of that environment and give them the quality time experience in a fun venue of some sort, or just out for a cup of coffee, out for dinner. The need to just have social connection with people who truly care is just invaluable, because caregiving is very socially isolating. And that is something we talk about in the book in terms of the difference between, you know, grief and mourning. Grief is something that's internal, But mourning is external. It's an experience that we share with other people. And many people end up grieving in isolation instead of mourning in the presence of the body of Christ and their friends and family. So the social part of this is extraordinarily important, and it's important not only for the caregiver to have the strength and the energy to face, you know, the daily struggles of caregiving, but it's also important in preventing their own cognitive health from going in a bad direction. That's one of the things that's recommended that people really focus on is social connection, because, you know, we're made to be social creatures. We're made to interact and support one another, and caregiving can have an isolating effect, and we want to combat that. So from a friendship perspective, I would say send a text, get on the phone, take them out for, you know, a bite to eat or whatever it is you're able to do.
Mm. Well, and you wrote about just how if someone's love language happens to be physical touch, for example, that as that person with dementia or Alzheimer's continues to deteriorate down that path, then there is no physical touch or no reciprocal touch, I guess, that someone who has had possibly been married for 25 years or more has been experiencing, and then all of a sudden that's taken away. That maybe as a friend, just a pat on the back or a hug or making sure that they're receiving some of that physical touch is going to be a way that we can love them.
Absolutely. That's extremely important. You're absolutely right, and especially if it happened to be their love language. But even if it's not their love language, that's just one more way where we connect with other people. And, you know, Jesus touched people. And if you're isolated with a person who can't be that affectionate partner that you're used to, it becomes all the more important, you know, for adult children to give mom or dad that hug and, you know, offer to do the foot rub and the back rub and, you know, whatever it is that would help them relax and just enjoy a little comfort that way.
And again, that just moves back to the necessity of really understanding what your friend or your spouse's love language are at the time. Will those continue then as they go down that journey of dementia, or will those change?
The person who's the caregiver, their love language is not likely to change, although we do mention in the book that circumstances might elevate the importance of a different love language for a time. If there's a particular need, like maybe, you know, it snowed and the driveway has 2 feet of snow, even if acts of service is not someone's love language, if that person is exhausted from caregiving and a neighbor shows up with a snow shovel, that speaks love in volumes. And it's just being attuned to what is the need? You know, what need could I meet for this person right now?
Well, and I'm assuming it's like any time when the person who's caring for the person with dementia doesn't want to be a burden on their friends or relatives as well. And so they may say, I don't need help, or I'm okay, or, you know, they don't want to express what they really need. But you write that it's actually really important if someone asks how they can help to give them something specific to do.
Absolutely. I would say even make a list so that when someone says, what can I do? You know, your mind won't be blank. You'll be, well, let me pull out my list. Here are some things that would really be helpful to me. And most people really do want to help, but they don't know what to do. And they're going to take their cue from the caregiver. So it's important, you know, to be in touch with what you really do need and to be able, not be shy about sharing that, because, you know, the need for help is very real.
Well, I've been talking to Deborah Barr today about her book, Keeping Love Alive as Memories Fade, The Five Love Languages and the Alzheimer's Journey. Deborah, thanks so much for joining us today. You've really opened our eyes to not only what people with Alzheimer's, how they are suffering, but for the people who are caring for them as well.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a great pleasure.
Well, bless you on your day. And thank you for joining us on Connecting Faith. We'll be right back.
says I'll be by your side wherever you fall into at night. Whenever you call and please don't fight these hands that are holding you. And my hands are holding you. Look at these hands at my side. Swallow the grave on that night when I drank the world's sin so I could carry you in.
Thanks so much for joining us on Connecting Faith. I'm Joe Bender in for Neil Stavem today. Well, we just heard from just a wonderful interview, heartfelt interview from Deborah Barr, who wrote a book called Keeping Love Alive as Memories Fade, and how to use the five love languages that Gary Chapman developed in the Alzheimer's journey. So fascinating discussion. I encourage you to go to myfaithradio.com and click on the podcast of today's show if you'd like to hear more about that. Also, we had a guest, Ken Abraham, who was on a while ago with Neil, and he answered some really difficult questions just about the reality of dementia from his book, When Your Parent Becomes Your Child, A Journey of Faith Through My Mother's Dementia. Also, just listen in.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My father has had vascular dementia for 19 years, and I struggle as a Christian with when to allow him to make decisions for himself and when I override his decisions for him and how to be respectful and loving at the same time.
Oh, Kelly, that is great. And boy, you just hit on two great words, respectful and loving. That kind of sums it up right there. Respectful, we never are out from under the command to honor our father and our mother. And in everything that we do in this whole process, even though our parents have become our kids in a lot of ways, your parent becomes your child, the whole idea of the book, you still have to respect mom. You still have to respect your dad. And yet, at the same time, what is the loving thing to do for them? Those two words that you just said, that's the key right there. What is the loving thing to do? Is it a loving thing to allow my dad to go out and drive a car when he's a danger to himself or a danger to other people? Is it a loving thing to to allow him to handle his own medications when there's a real possibility that he may overdose on something? Or, like, for example, my mom was on Coumadin, a very familiar blood thinner. Well, if she took too much Coumadin, she could bleed out. If she even just bumped her arm or something, it would begin bleeding. So you just have to say, what is the loving thing to do? And at that point, you need to step in and do. It's hard. Boy, it's just really hard to take authority over mom and dad's decisions. You want to give them as much autonomy as possible. But at the same time, you've got to be realistic and say, for the very best care I can give mom or dad, I've got to take this away. I can't allow. My mom used to love helping in the kitchen. She used to love peeling the potatoes, taking a knife or a potato peeler. It got to the place where we couldn't allow her to do that because she would cut herself more than the potatoes. But you just have to be realistic and say, okay, step by step here, we're moving back to childhood. And I've got to recognize that I'm not dealing with the person that taught me how to drive a car anymore. Now I'm teaching the person who maybe just growing up and learning even what a car is. I've got to help that person grapple with life.
And you talked about the kitchen. You know, one of the issues you had was just kind of helping your mom make sure she was getting not only the right medication but the right food or eating. Not eating is pretty common too, isn't it?
That's right. A lot of folks with dementia and Alzheimer's, they'll just stop eating altogether. And more as they approach the end of things, that becomes a situation that works, unfortunately, in the person's demise. It just works against them on so many levels. But the lack of an appetite or the change of appetite, those kind of things are signs to watch for, because that could be an indication of where we are in this whole process of dementia. We found too something else that was helpful. You were asking for tips earlier, Neil. One of the things that we learned quickly is that my mom could not handle, and most dementia and Alzheimer's patients cannot, they can't handle a bunch of instructions at one time. One or two instructions they could deal with, okay? Take the potatoes over to the sink. We're going to peel the potatoes. Take the potatoes over to the sink. But we couldn't give her instructions, take the potatoes over to the sink, peel the potatoes, put them in the water, put them on the sink. No, one instruction at a time she could handle, but more than that, she would get confused. And that's common with a lot of folks with dementia and Alzheimer's. Eating is something important. Sometimes you have to start mashing up the food, you know, using a food processor. It just becomes, because you don't want them to choke, and things aren't working as well as they used to, and so you just have to be a little bit careful about those kinds of things. Watch that diet. It's important. Water. Water intake. There's something else that is important, too. It's a physical thing, Neil, but it has so many emotional ramifications, and that is touch. Especially when mom or dad are in a nursing home or an assisted care facility, unfortunately, except for the nurses and the doctors, nobody touches them. They don't touch each other. It's a strange thing. And that physical touch we all need, mom and dad need that more than ever. Put your arm around, get down in front of their eyes. Don't get off to the side because their peripheral vision isn't what it used to be. Get right in front of them so you don't scare them when you reach your hand out to touch mom or dad. Let them see you coming so that you touch them in a gentle way. But that physical touch is so important for a person with dementia and Alzheimer's.
One of the other tips you talked about was that don't argue, but change the subject. Talk a little bit more about that.
That was the key for us. That's how we survived this whole thing, I have to tell you. Because, you know, people with dementia and Alzheimer's, they get argumentative sometimes. And you know, it becomes a really important issue, whether it's red or blue or what we're going to do here. And, boy, you know, it'll just drive you crazy. It is so frustrating. And mom or dad, you know, they're just convinced that's what the way it is. And you can spend a lot of time arguing. But, you know what? We found that if we would just change the subject, my mom might say something was blue or red. We'd say, you know, mom, that's true. Have you noticed that Alyssa is getting older and you know, she's off to college? You know, just change the subject, any subject. It doesn't matter. Just change the subject. A minute or two later, that person with dementia or Alzheimer's may not even remember the point that they were so upset about just a few minutes earlier. Changing the subject, it sounds so simple. Oh, Neil, that was a salvation point for us. It just saved our lives in so many ways.
And I know you are a former senior pastor, and you've written a number of books and, you know, still teaching Bible studies and all those things. So, you know, one of our listeners just wrote a note, and maybe you can talk a little bit about it. But, you know, is this something where, you know, if we really were serious in prayer about it, I mean, even laying hands on our parents, is this a spiritual warfare issue? Did you work through some of those things? I mean, you sort of touched on that when you were visiting with the doctors.
Absolutely. And that was my first impression. Quite frankly, you know, whatever mom's ailments are, you know what? God can heal her. And I believe in what the Bible says. If somebody is sick, let's call the elders together. Let's anoint them with oil. Let's pray. And if they've committed sin, they'll be forgiven and God will heal them. He will raise them up. I believe that all my life. My mom believed that, Neil. We did those things with my mom. Guess what? The dementia kept moving increasingly more and more toward her demise. This is life we're dealing with. You know what? We're not in heaven yet, but at the same time, it's a fight. And so we fought as hard and as long as we possibly could in every spiritual way, and I would recommend folks to do that. Here's the other thing, too. Pray with your mom. Pray with your dad. It was incredible what would happen to my mom's spirits whenever we would pray. And here's the other part, when she would pray for us. Wow. We were having some trouble with our teenage daughter one time, and so I asked my mom to pray for her. Neil, it was like God gave her a direct pipeline. And boy, she was just reading my daughter's mail, you know? And she was just, and we had not told her what was going on in our daughter's life, but the Spirit of God working in my mom was still there. And so there's just something very, very important to maintain that spiritual aspect of this whole thing. Don't give up. And yet at the same time, we recognize this life is not all there is. And it was a marvelous thing, Neil, for us to know that the moment my mom took her last breath in Nashville, Tennessee, she was going to take her first breath on Streets of Gold in heaven with Jesus. Man, you know what? It just bolstered all of our faith just knowing that if she closed her eyes and didn't wake up, that wasn't going to be the worst thing that could ever happen. The worst thing that could happen if she closed her eyes without Jesus. My mom knew Jesus. She was looking forward to seeing him. And for us to hold on to her and say, Mom, stay here with us. Stay here. You know, please don't go. That was almost cruel on our parts. And we had to come to the place where we were willing to let her go as well.
Just some wise words, great content from Ken Abraham. Who had talked with Neil about when your parent becomes a child. So certainly some issues that many of us are going to face either now or in the future, and very scary things as well. If you just joined us and you want to get a copy or listen to that podcast, you can go to myfaithradio.com, click on Connecting Faith, and you can listen to a podcast of today's show with Deborah Barr and Ken Abraham. Also, we have a great guest coming on tomorrow. We're going to talk with wealth management advisor David McElveny. He'll show us how to build the an intentional future with our children and their children as well, as we talk about his book, The Intentional Legacy, What You Want for Your Family, Why You Want It, and How to Get There. Neil will be back tomorrow. Thanks so much.